Welcome to Online Gods, a podcast about digital cultures in India and beyond. Today we're speaking with Angela Zito about media as religion, and with Kufir Nalgundwar about Dalit online media and Roundtable India. India is a country with a lot of gods. And I wonder if digital media is engendering the creation of a few more idols, a few more names to worship, online gods to add to our pantheon, whichever one we subscribe to. In this podcast series, we explore the emergence of new digital cultures and how they link to religion and politics and nationalism. We ask how the growth of online media is changing the public sphere in India and elsewhere. This is episode 2. If you listened to episode 1, only would you have heard me talk with Ralph Schroeder about big data, Anisha Susan about the online women's magazine The Lady's Finger, but you also would have heard me say that this podcast is part of a wider project on digital dignity, led by media anthropologist and all-round good egg Sahana Udupa, a professor at LMU in Germany. Also, I told you that it's co-hosted by the How Network for Ethnographic Theory. And finally, that each week we're going to be speaking to both an academic expert from the world of new media, politics, or religion about a key concept from their work, and also an online god, a virtual deity from the online media realm, an individual who uses media in fresh or important ways. Of course, there is being important and also pretending to be important. I thought of this when I saw news stories about a loophole in Facebook that allowed accounts to generate fake likes. Supposedly 100 million fake likes have been garnered. You might ask yourself, why do people do this? Well, partly it's to appear higher up people's news feeds, as the more likes you have, the higher you appear up. And thus you gain real attention, and maybe also some real likes, to go with the fake likes that you've paid for. Now this is important if you want to sell something, push your political opinion, or maybe even set up or promote a religion. However, maybe you don't need to use social media to promote a religion online, when such media can, it has been argued, function in a very similar way to religion itself. Confused? Unconvinced? Well, just listen to our interview with our first guest, Angela Zito. When I first started thinking about religion and the media, my mind wandered, rather predictably, to those channels that I occasionally stumbled along when looking for something to watch on telly late at night. You know, those channels where religious leaders discuss ideas or preach about a certain topic. But even though I don't watch such channels, I realised that I'm exposed to people using the media to celebrate or spread religion each and every day. I see countless WhatsApp or Facebook memes and messages, especially from my Indian friends, and especially though only at times of festivals. In this way, religious people use the media, but religion is, of course, in the media in many ways as well. In the storylines of films and TV shows, in newspaper reports, in cartoons. These two ways of thinking about religion are, of course, important. But there is also, as I realised when reading the work of anthropologist Angela Zito, another way of thinking about media and religion. The way that media functions in a similar way to religion. Luckily, you don't have to hear my interpretation of her thinking, but rather we have her on the line. Hi, Angela. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Hi, Ian. Nice to be here.
Angela is an associate professor in anthropology at NYU, where she's also co-founder and co-director of the Center for Religion and Media. We're going to talk mostly about media and religion today, but I first came across Angela's work on rituals in China, and you should definitely check out that if you have a moment. And her interests range even wider than this, including the anthropology of embodiment, gender, performance, and documentary film. So let's start with the big question that I hope has been burning in the listeners' minds since I raised it a few moments before. How can we think of media as religion?
Ah, well, now, you know, you detailed two of the ways that the Center for Religion and Media had took up the problem of the relationship between religion and media. One is how religious people use media themselves, and this is particularly in religions that are evangelizing, religions that seek converts, right? It would be Christianity, certainly, Buddhism, Islam. But of course, I think this is the greatness of the new project that you guys are working on in India. I think that there's been a shift in Hinduism, that it has become much more public and far more aggressive in trying to pursue identity projects. Not that everybody needs to convert to Hinduism, but that there's some much more public presence of being Hindu, which then implies a lot of media use. But to go back to these evangelizing religions, they use media a lot. It's built into their own religious project, right? Then there is the idea that religion is represented by the media. So it appears in the eyes of different other people. This is not from the inside of a religious tradition, but it's from the outside of that tradition. And sort of, so there's going to be series of representations that people will fight about. They might be stereotypes. So that's religion in the media, right? So there's religion using media, there's religion in the media. And then there's how media itself functions as religion, right? And in that sense, we have to dig deeper into how religion itself, what religion does for people. And we can turn to, you know, anthropology, sociology, psychology, those long-standing projects about what religious life was thought to do for people. And of course, what does religion do? Well, it provides people with a sense of identity very often. It provides them with a sense of community within that identity. So it neatly helps you as a person to feel that you are becoming yourself at the same time that you're doing it with a crowd of other people who are also becoming themselves in the same way that you are becoming yourself. Now, what could make people feel better in their life? So that's one of the ways that, media itself nowadays, especially in the world of social media, clearly has very similar projects. One of the ways that we saw this coming on board was with the vast transmedia platforms of fandom, right, where around a certain set of novels, like, of course, the Harry Potter phenomenon, and actually this started even earlier with Star Trek, right, but with Harry Potter, with Twilight, we get these vast groups of people who stay in touch, who imagine new stories, who write fan fiction, who buy things, who gather together, of course, then in the body, right, at conventions and so on. So in that sense, we can see that their engagement with the rituals of their media life, right, something that you might consider, oh, this is something quite separate from religion. Their commitment to that, to those media worlds, right, can stand in or looks very much like religion. So if the anthropologist arrives, you know, from the other star system and they're looking around and they're going to find the Harry Potter people, you know, or the Twilight people back in the day. So that's one of the ways that I think there's that connection that's a little different.
And I'm thinking a bit more about religion and media, or maybe before I started to think about it too deeply. I think I used to think of somehow religion and media belonging to different spheres, somehow media as part of the secular sphere, you know, where you've got TV or Twitter and so on. I somehow imagine those as being somehow a secular balance that modernity brought in against the sort of voice of authority of religion over time. But, you know, this, of course, isn't really the case. Like, you know, religion has really thrived with modernity and with the sort of technologies that arrive. So why do you think that religion adapts so well to all the new mediums that modernity throws at it?
Well, religions actually have been profoundly, they've been media innovators, in fact, of course, because, you know, printing was invented by the Chinese, and the earliest printed work was to print Buddhist sutras. And this is because, of course, Buddhist sutras, the propagation of the sutra itself is the most meritorious act that you can commit, as it were, in Mahayana Buddhism. In every sutra, at the end of a Mahayana sutra, it will be the phrase, in the ways that you can gain merit, and it will go through various things, but then the kicker will always be, and you can make a copy of this, you can propagate this sutra. So the development of printing, of woodblock printing, in order to do this begins with the Chinese in medieval China. And then, of course, we have, you know, the famous story of the Gutenberg Press and its commitment to the production of the Bible and so on. So, you know, just in terms of those two forms of technology, which are massively important, there was a religious impulse behind their propagation. So I find it, I've always found that to be just an interesting, an interesting conceit. It's a really great post-Enlightenment conceit. I mean, let's face it, there's been a full court press on in Europe since it's a post-Reformation and then Enlightenment movement to move religion off center stage. And to, and that's a very, very complicated history. That has much more to do, I would say, with new forms of authority and of actual control over people's everyday lives and the contestation for that authority against the church, right? Or then against churches, so that it was then thought to be the purview of the king, of other forms of government. And so that's part of the complex history of why religion seems to be better marginalized, you know, and why we ought to have other forms of being together and other forms of communication that escape, right? Religious engagement. And it's very important in terms of the rise of course, the whole view of science, you know, of natural science, which felt that it was going to, which was set up to, again, also achieve escape velocity from stranglehold, really. I mean, the monopoly, you could say, that the church had upon literacy and upon learning, you know. And so as the church's monopoly over literacy, which had to do with its vast monastic systems, its vast systems of clergy and their patronage, as that was weakened, and again, you can see how this is less to do with media and much more to do with authority over persons, you know, and who is going to get to know things, who is going to have access to knowledge. So all of this starts to kind of crumble in various ways. It's like a house of pickup sticks or a house of, you pull one thing out, you pull another thing out. Soon the whole thing goes down. And soon from our vantage point in the present, it's very hard for us to see the intricate connections among all of these things, you know? And we end up with what's left and what's transmitted to us, which is, I think, in a sense, neatly encapsulated by your opening remarks, which is, indeed, modernity is about the separation of church and state, of secular versus religious, and so on. That's a very late outcome of a very, very complicated process that's also very European and Northern American and, you know, I mean, Anglophonic, Francophonic, and so on. Because, you know, these are not things that are happening in other parts of the world, which you guys from your perspective in India would certainly understand. Or they're vastly different histories of the parsing out of governance, right?
For sure.
And of the control of knowledge, right? Yes. Which is also what we're talking about here. The stakes of the control of the production of knowledge and who is going to really have control of that. And I think this must be something that's deeply contested right now in the Indian situation.
My final question to you today is the final question that we ask all of our guests coming on the podcast. Yes. And this is a podcast which is part of a wider project on digital dignity. So I was wondering if you could tell us what digital dignity might mean to you.
Again, I think that's an excellent question. And one of the projects that the Center for Religion and Media has been involved in on a very, very long term has been the promoting of documentary film. I'll give a shout out to my collaborator and co-founder, Faye Ginsburg, who founded in the anthropology department here at NYU, her Culture and Media program, which is a program that teaches how to make video documentary always. And so what we've been interested in is in the ethical activist uses of video in various ways. And so, of course, as more social media work has come online, as it were, and as our digital life has become more ramified and taking up more of our physical everyday time life. Mm-hmm. This has extended to, website use, website building, besides just the idea of making documentaries that have an ethical activist cast. So when I think of digital dignity, I also think about the sharing of the production of media amongst more people. And while I don't want to sound like one of those, utopic, digital democracy kind of people, there is something that is quite extraordinary about the genuine fact that people carry around a small camera with them all the time now, and they can digitally document aspects of their everyday life, and they do so, and they share this. And this, to me, is an increase in a claim to digital dignity on the part of people.
Wonderful. That's a really great answer. Thank you for that and for all of your other answers as well. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
You're welcome, Ian. It was a great pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed listening to Angela as much as I did. I think apart from her main argument that media functions as a type of religion, there are another couple of really interesting things here that I want to highlight. One is the way that she suggested that religious groups are media innovators. This was really interesting how she historicized it, but also we can see this today in many different areas. And also the way she suggested that rituals in media life are also similar to other rituals in other parts of our life. Talking of media and religion, we might want to be a little bit playful and suggest, well, if media is a religion, then it should have functionaries who are somehow similar to those that can be found in the media world. After all, this podcast is called Online Gods, Playing on Such an Idea. And if that's the case, then we might want to ask, who are the high priests of this religion called media? Well, somebody who would be very good at identifying the high priests of media is our next guest, Kofi Nalgundwar. Kofi is one of the three founders of Roundtable India, a website that serves as a platform, tool, and resource by, about, and for Dalit Bahujans. For those of you who aren't familiar with the Indian context, Dalit is a word that means broken in Hindi, and is used to refer to those castes, or rather jatis, of people in India against whom untouchability has been practiced. It was popularized by the Dalit reformer B.R. Ambedkar and is a consciously political term. Bahujan, meanwhile, means majority, as the so-called lower castes make up a majority in India. Now, as we'll see in the following interview, religion and media become entwined, as Kofi doesn't call the mainstream media the mainstream media, but rather the Manu-stream media. That is the media which follows the path of Manu. That is the Manusmriti, an ancient legal text in which, among other things, the hierarchies of caste, or rather Varna, are laid out. As you'll see, Roundtable India is very clear about its political positioning, but it has many types of articles contained within it, all in English and all written by volunteers. I spoke with Kofi not only about Roundtable India, but also about Dalits in the media and the benefits and pitfalls of online media. So it gives me great pleasure to welcome Kofi to Online Gods. Let's dive straight into the big question at the heart of your work. And I want to ask you, what's the problem with mainstream, or also what's called alternative media, in regards to how they cover or how they don't cover caste? Is it simply a lack of Dalit journalists working in the field, or is there something more going on?
The problem is much more deeper and much more wider. You know, it's not just a question of representation of a few Dalit journalists, because the caste is not a question of Dalits alone or of untouchability alone. It's about structural deprivation of rights and resources to the majority of the Indian population, which is lower caste in some way or the other. So these are all underrepresented. The Dalits mainly being the most suppressed. They're also severely underrepresented. There is zero representation in national media as such, national electronic media especially. So it is not just a question of representation, because the In the media, because the representation in legislatures, in executive arms of government and institutions of governance, and you know, teaching institutions or universities, research institutions, in corporate businesses, in even in civil society, most of India's protest movements are led by upper caste. So they, this is you can see all through. The scope is very, very limited at every stage. So the, to even into any kind of modern institutions, even like a school, because the most majority of the lower caste live in the villages. So the schools in the villages are the most under, you know, funded and the most neglected. The literacy levels among the lower caste, functional literacy, would be very, very low. Don't get the basic access to such things as such tools as even in a computer or a fan or electricity or a toilet in their schools, in the villages. So this is the majority which is applied in at every step. So the national media, which is by default, it is funded by huge capital, and it funded, it has the protection of, you know, several democratic laws and norms, and also international support. That is the last point which we could reach. You know, that is the, you know, that is the top. The majority inside this modern institutions, which represent power and wealth and resources, control over the whole country's political economy, is held by the upper caste, led by the Brahmins. So it is. So this this isn't just about, you know, not being covered by the mainstream. So we feel, you know, we are not allowed to speak our own voices anyway. We don't have a platform. We don't have a platform because we lack capital. We also lack, you know, lot of other things to come together, and and we are dispersed. So and we are not, you know, even if we would like to, as outsiders, some may like to write in news, mainstream newspaper, that is not, you know, possible.
So, so this was the reason why you set up something like Roundtable India.
Yeah, this was the, you know, the inspiration is from Baba Saab's own efforts itself, Dr. Ambedkar, I am referring to. Dr. Ambedkar had started on four different occasions, four different periodicals, because he had lacked capital at every, so, at every, you know, time, at every event of launching. So all this had to close down, four different, you know, he did make, because he was the one who realized the importance of education and documenting our history. So he said, you know, if you don't know your history, you can't change your future. So so that, you know, that is an inspiration. And there is, it in English, there is a growing middle class, or a tiny middle class among the Dalit Bahujans, as we call them, lower caste collectively, which can now, you know, write in English, and who have been to universities, and who know how to write, you know, and, so, and research. So we felt at least we can provide a base, the basic minimum of a platform, wherein we could express, you know, all kinds of different shades of our opinion from different spaces, you know, not just, you know, geographies also. And men, women, and all. If a, if a, if a paper or a television channel in the name of, you know, Dalits and other lower castes started in India, it would definitely be done by one of these mainstream groups. You know, but, so because, you know, only they would be able to do it.
So I understand you don't want to be, how to say, you're sort of forced by structural conditions to exist outside of mainstream media. But I was wondering, do you then worry that...
There is another point, there is a little point I would like to make here. We are the majority of the people in this country, so we consider ourselves the mainstream. So they are what we call the Manu stream. So the, they are the stream which follows the path of Manu. So we are the mainstream. They are the minority who hold everything. So, you know, the, so we will grow. And there are other sites which have come up after we made our efforts, you know, start in 2009. And it has been a regular effort after that. Now, what I felt very, very important that we do it consistently. So we didn't make put our goals too high, you know, objectives too high. Let's do everything at, you know, at once. So we said we'll go step by step and we'll do it gradually. And we'll learn as we go and we'll, you know, make it a democratic process wherein a lot of people will be involved in the shaping of this platform. So all the writers are in some ways or other are also involved in shaping this platform. So we are a core group of only three people who started it, the founders, editors, and but we seek advice. We are on constant interaction with other, you know, friends and activists and writers and researchers and teachers and professors. So we can't live in kind of isolation in within a certain newsroom. Our newsroom is very virtual and very open. So, and we can't afford to actually race against time and be like CNN or, you know, that is the model. Now, 24 hours everywhere, everything has to be covered. We don't feel the necessity to cover it because as it is, the everyday deprivations and struggles of life does overwhelm the Bhojan a lot. So what we feel is that we need to take a more analytical, reflective approach. And given our resources, we can't have reporters everywhere. We have to depend on volunteers to write on issues and events. So it has been shaped in that fashion. In the early stages, we thought maybe we could do news and all. Maybe there would be volunteers who would be willing to work without any payment. So, but it would be unjust on them also. So we three we have some kind of jobs. So we can put in, you know, I'm in my 50s, so there are some savings which I put in here and into publishing books. So it's a totally online space. Without online possibilities, there would have been nothing, you know, there would not have been a Roundtable India or a platform like that.
And you mentioned that since you started in 2009, since then other initiatives have come up. I'm thinking I've seen online like Dalit Camera or Ambedkar's Caravan and so on. I was wondering, what's your relationship with them? Are these largely independent things or are you in contact? Or what about regional languages as well? Like, because mostly these are in English
or
Hindi.
They are friends, actually. They are all friends in some ways. And the we have a different focuses. Dalit Camera has always, you know, he has written a lot on Roundtable India also. Ravichandran, who started it, he comes from a very marginalized background and from Tamil Nadu, and he used to study here in Hyderabad in English and Foreign Languages University. So that's how we got to meet. So he started, you know, but just a handheld camera, basic, you know, aim and shoot camera kind of. So then he started with that and then he got some support later on. So, and Veliwada, which is Dr. Ambedkar's caravan, is Pardeep. He is based in the UK, I think. Pardeep, so now he must be based in the UK. So Pardeep is younger and he focuses on the younger lot a lot, I think. I mean, this is not, we have something we have discussed formally. We'll do this, you'll do that. It does grow, you know. So there would be many more people if it was in some way their services could be recompensated. In the regional language, there are many, many more people who write regularly, publish regularly, in, you know, books of poetry, magazines, and then they, you know, drop out because of lack of resources. There would be many more if there was an, you know, in regional languages and in English, if there was some kind of support for these individuals. Basically, these are very small groups of individuals who reach out to much larger groups. So, just like Roundtable India, just from initially it was three people, and then we have now 500 or 600 writers who, and translators and others who have been involved in this effort in some way or other. So, it will expand. There will be more people. But capital as such would not be so very forthcoming. It will only go to those groups which have already established national media, other media groups.
And other funding models or possibilities for funding that might exist outside asking for big injections of capital by corporate groups. I'm thinking I saw like a recent newish website in India, thewire.in, that was launched, yeah. And they seem to get their funding from many different places. Is such a possibility open, you think, for Dalit groups? Or
No. Wire, we consider, they call themselves alternative group. They are mainstream. All the journalists working there, lots of years of international experience. It's a startup. Let's recognize it for what it is. It is a startup.
Okay.
And we would rather keep out of the way of both capital and the state.
Yes.
So it is, now we don't even dream of that. And because this is, enthusiastic voluntary support and a sense of ownership.
I was wondering if we could change track a little bit. So I was thinking we talk about caste, and we also maybe should talk a little bit about class. Or because when I was like looking at a lot of Roundtable India's output, it's clear that it's written by educated, highly literate people who are very comfortable, expressing complex arguments in a sophisticated English and so on. Yeah. And I was just wondering, is this also your audience of readers, or if you've also tried to reach out to other groups that might not call themselves Dalits, because of course Dalit is a conscious category that that might call themselves SC or OBC or never even have heard the word Dalit, and maybe use it and consume a different sort of media.
They are some upper class writers among the 500, 600, but it's around 10 or 12 people, not more.
Okay,
because they don't want to write, even when they write, mostly we don't practice caste. We don't stop anyone from writing in Roundtable, sending articles to Roundtable India. So we don't. But they consciously don't write here, they would be better recognized probably elsewhere. But when they want to, project their own social sensitivity, they want at least one article in Roundtable India. A lot of people, academics also want. Journalists would also love to have their article. It's not that we're not trying to reach out. Trying to reach out among our own people is a bigger effort. Even right now, we have represented only the proverbial tip of the iceberg, and there would be many more, much more. Mm-hmm. And as you remarked, most of them are highly educated, and when they're, any typical page of 12 articles, you'll see that around 8 are PhDs, are trying to do their PhDs, and some more are postgraduates. Lawyers from top law schools and all.
Mm-hmm.
So this kind of writing, knowledge capabilities, you won't find even in Wire or in any other newspaper. I can assure her that, because I myself found it very surprising that we keep producing this. These people keep writing, and you can imagine this kind of people with such kind of educational qualifications and capability, they are writing in our space, because they don't have access to other spaces as much as they deserve.
But on this exactly, then is there an effort from Dalit media organizations to try and speak to those Dalits who are maybe not as highly literate as the people who are usually reading something like Roundtable India? I'm just thinking that like a lot of like WhatsApp groups or Facebook pages that I'm in, then groups that I'm assuming you'll be very opposed to, like Hindutva groups and so on, they manage very well to communicate their messages through videos, through GIFs, through memes and so on. And I'm wondering, is there a similar effort on the part of Dalit media organizations or not?
Yeah, there is always an effort. You will find many interviews of people whose primary language is the regional language, and most of our thinkers actually speak in regional languages more and write in regional languages more. Most of our history happens there, so we are a kind of a cream of which has been skimmed off all these regions.
As a final question, I was wondering if we can talk a bit more generally about what this move to doing media online is doing to debate in India. I know you mentioned before that something like Roundtable India wouldn't be able to exist if it wasn't for the internet. And I saw in your personal Twitter handle, you wrote that you think that Twitter amplifies the distance between man and kind. So obviously you're aware that sometimes these online debates can become quite nasty at times as well. And I've also checked, of course, your Twitter feed, and you've been in some quite feisty debates with some journalists about certain issues. So I was wondering if you could reflect a bit, you know, do you think that, you know, discussions online are conducive to dignified discussions?
They're not conducive, especially in spaces like Twitter, wherein, you know, majority are 95%, 98% Brahmin, Savarna, or upper caste. They already have a certain kind of knowledge capital, and they already are connected in some ways, you could say, telepathically to each other's thoughts, and they don't have, you know, sometimes you say, you know, we are friends, like we don't even have to, you know, we finish off each other's sentences. So those people can pick up from where their, you know, caste fellows from across India, from across the world, you know, and their people don't even need know each other. They speak the same kind of language, the same kind of trans waves and frequencies, and the language itself, that language itself is so very, you know, and so I found it, because I myself, I'm 54 now. I was new to social media. I stuck to Twitter because initially there were no Dalit, whatever, except for me and a couple of others. So despite all the Sanghis also attacking us and all these liberals not being very, you know, they're playing their own game and all that. It is not, I mean, it dehumanizes you and brutalizes you. I think in some ways, if, you know, we make up, and, you know, these days it's better because there are more Dalit students and others, and other people can't speak as, you know, abusively and without any regard for consequences as earlier.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for this answer and for all your other answers. It's been really great having a conversation with you today. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you, Ian. I hope we can keep in touch.
I hope you agree with me that listening to Kofir was absolutely fascinating, and I think he did a couple of really important things in regards to our exploration into the online media sphere. He reminded us that the online structural inequalities set the contours of online media, even as online media offers new platforms or new possibilities for unheard or previously unheard voices. And he also mentioned the vibrancy of regional language media, something Sahana Udupa calls Bhasha media. That is to say, it's not just a media in a different language, but that the media is anchored, this regional language media is anchored in cultural logics of each region. And it's different from English media, even that English media which comes from the same place. Anyway, that's it from us today. So thanks so much for all your kind words about episode one. We had really great feedback. As a reminder, please subscribe to the podcast. Very soon, I'm going to stop spamming the world with emails and Facebook messages. So please use RSS feeds or iTunes. And if you are using iTunes, also please rate us. If you want to get in touch with us, and I urge you to do so, then you can get in touch with us via Twitter or Facebook at 4 Digital Dignity, or on our website, fordigitaldignity.com, or you can drop us an email at onlinegodspodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again for listening. Ta-ra! Thank you so much for listening to the Online Gods podcast. Online Gods is part of the project Online RPOL, funded by the European Research Council, starting grant agreement number 714285. The project's PI is Sahana Udupa, who's Professor of Media Anthropology at the Department of Social and Cultural Anthropology, Ludwig Maximilian University, Munich, Germany. This podcast, like all the podcasts, is brought to you in collaboration with the HOW Network for Ethnographic Theory, my personal favourite network for ethnographic theory. I've been your host, Ian Cook. Goodbye.